What's going on, my haunted, horror-loving hamsters? I don't know what to say anymore. On this episode, we talk with horror author and content creator Damon Manx. You're going to love it. Please check it out only on the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast. Let's go.
Do aliens exist, and are they among us? Are weird creatures lurking in the darkness? Do evil entities hide in the shadows of your bedroom while you sleep? Join us as we explore all this and more on the Warped Reality Podcast.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast. I'm your host, Ghost Joe. Before we get into this awesome interview that I recently had with horror author Damon Manx, I wanted to talk about something kind of serious here. So by now, we've all kind of heard of the LA wildfires and all of the destruction that it is causing. A lot of people are very quick to judge and make comments, believing that this is only affecting the rich people out there. But that is far from the truth. A great friend of mine, as well as the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcasts, Treble Garcia, he hosts the awesome Paranoia Radio podcast. He lives out there, and he is a normal guy with a normal job and a normal family living in a normal home. Okay, so luckily in his area, the fires have dissipated significantly, and him and his family are safe, but many are not. So let's be a little bit more considerate and courteous in this matter, okay? Also, you should go check out the Paranoia Radio podcasts. It's a truther podcast that will keep you guys informed and make you think just a little bit harder about things that are going on around us. The link for the podcast is always in my show notes, and it always will be. So definitely check them out. They are awesome. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about time travel, all right? I think everyone has wished that we could go back into a DeLorean and travel back and fix some things or see someone that we haven't seen in a very long time with some time travel, right? It's been a fascinating thought for a long time, with some very smart people even working on it, such as Nikola Tesla did. But let's talk about the most convincing story about time travel. And that starts with Mr. Sergei Ponomarenko, a 25-year-old Ukrainian man who involuntarily traveled from the year 1958 in Kyiv and landed in 2006 Kyiv, Ukraine. He was actually arrested for having, you know, had strange behavior while he was walking around. He looked kind of confused and disoriented. And when questioned, he told the police that he was actually born in 1932. He was carrying around an old camera from that time and was dressed in clothing from that period as well. He even had documents from the Soviet Union showing his age. And the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, you know? When the police developed the pictures, I didn't know that they did that, actually. That's pretty cool. I could just take my film over there and they could develop it. That's cool. They saw Ponomarenko in these photos with a woman. And the settings of these pictures were said to have been from the 1950s. Well, when they looked for the woman, she mentioned that it was her in the pictures and that her boyfriend had disappeared without a trace, only to reappear again 2 years later. The police even found records of a missing man from 1958 with his same name. She had also claimed that she had received a picture from Sergei with him in Kyiv in the year 2050. So what do you guys think? Could this be a real time traveler or just a very, very good con man? That reminds me, if you have a paranormal experience you'd like to share, leave us a voicemail at 845-600-0744, or you could email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. And now, for the main event, take a listen to my interview with horror author and content creator Damon Manx. With us today is horror author Damon Manx. He penned the Ojanok series, Abigail, numerous horror short stories. He's a content creator and a former Wheel of Fortune contestant. Let's welcome Mr. Damon Manx.
Hey, Joe. Joe, how are you, my friend? Thanks for having me.
How's it going, man?
Today.
Absolutely, man. This is like a long time coming. We talked about this months ago, man. Back in September, I think.
Yeah, I remember seeing you at CT Horror Fest, and we were talking about it then. And I've been looking forward to it ever since.
Yeah, same here, man. That was a fun time too. I had went, and it's funny because I forgot that I had went to that 2 years prior. I had met David Howard Thornton there. So that was really cool to meet Art the Clown, you know.
Art has exploded. He is huge.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just the fact that, I mean, I know I heard it wasn't that great of a movie, but just the fact that he like completely obliterated the Joker movie, you know.
Well, he sure did. Who saw that coming? But,
right.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, the sky is the limit for the Terrifier series now.
Yeah. And I mean, I love it, man. I think honestly, he's like the best slasher, you know, horror guy to come out since Freddy Krueger, you know. I think he's definitely got a lot of staying power.
I love a slasher who's got a lot of comedic ability, you know, and right. Art is hysterically terrifying, you know.
I agree. I mean, and the actor himself, I mean, he's been doing a lot of like those weird, creepy roles, and he's perfect in all of them. I mean, he did an adaptation of The Grinch called The Mean One, which he was awesome in, you know, and he's also going to be coming in the new movie Scream Boat, where he plays Steamboat Willie.
oh wow, that sounds cool.
Yeah. He's pretty awesome. But so let's get into your thing, man. So when did you start writing horror? I know I had read, and I had actually listened to some of, I'm not much of a reader, but I had listened to the audiobook of the Oceanox book one from you. And I loved it, man. I loved it. And that narrator was awesome. So good.
JP Adams. I found that guy. I did about 20 to 30 different auditions for narrators to find the right guy. And this guy was kind of like, just like came out of the blue. Hadn't done a lot of work, but I heard him, and like he read just a short clip of the opening scene, and I'm like, well, this is the guy. There was no mistake. And I had some professional like horror book narrators who read for it, and JP Adams was without a doubt the only man for the job. But when did I get started? So I started writing at a young age, like, you know, toying around as somebody with aspirations for writing does. I remember trying to write a sequel to one of the Jaws movies at a very, very young age, which was terrible. And I then moved on to like writing songs. Like as I got to high school, I became a musician playing guitar, playing bass. So I was writing a lot of lyrics. I did not start writing horror until my life took a drastic turn for the worse. And I found myself doing time in the prison system. And it was there that I actually, I read a book called 20th Century Ghosts by Joe Hill. And the short stories in that book impacted me so much. I said, you know what? I want to do this. I think I can do this. And I've been writing ever since. And in a prison system is where I actually became a horror author and where I put pen to paper and first started. And I think that's probably a very different path than you'll hear from most horror authors.
One of the things that I had listened to in the beginning of the audiobook, you had talked about, you know, in the introduction about that. And you had said something that, I mean, I'm a correction officer, so I know all about jail and prison and stuff. And the one thing that you had said was that you were writing your book throughout, like the entire time with all the noise in the background and all these guys. I don't know how you did it. And the other thing, too, is I've never been the type that I can't study. I can't write stuff when I'm listening to music. I don't know how you did that. that's got to be like a huge skill, because I can't concentrate on all that stuff at once.
Yeah, so I mean, it's crazy. So the Oceanox series is a 4-book series, and I wrote that when I was towards the end of my prison sentence in the halfway house. And in the halfway house, You know, you got 12 guys sitting on top of each other in a dorm room setting. And there's, you know, they were loud. We were under COVID lockdown, so we weren't getting out of the building. So everybody was really tense. And they were very loud and very anxious and playing cards and playing rap music. And I was losing my mind. And I had just started to write The Ocean Oxen. And I put on my headphones and I found a local country station and just blasted that to drown them out, just to find something totally different than what they were doing. And it was just like, it blanketed out all the noise. And I sat there and I wrote for close to 6 hours a night, just nonstop. And within 6 months, I had the first draft of a 4-book series finished. And I can't write with music now. Like I need quiet. So I don't know how I was able to do this. And, you know, I think it was just kind of it's one of those things. The story needed to be written. The story was going to come out of me eventually somehow. And that was the time. And I kind of was like, I was like the conduit. I was like the delivery system for the story, because I kind of feel like the story has taken on a life of its own. And I feel like the story had a life of its own before I even wrote it, because there's so much of my own life put into that story that it's really, there's so much reality that it's borderline nonfiction.
Was horror like the genre that you always wanted to write? Or who were your influences, growing up?
Yeah, well, I mean, every horror author is going to say Stephen King, of course. You know, I've read Stephen King since I was young. Always loved Stephen King. I love large books that give you a world, you know, give you multiple characters. You're learning about these characters' lives and come to know these people and care about them when something tragic happens to them. And Stephen King is great for characterization and world building. So he's always been a huge influence of mine. His son, Joe Hill, who wrote 20th Century Ghost, is also a huge influence of mine. But one of the first books I ever remember reading that really inspired me in a literary sense was Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury, who just had the story itself really captures the mood and the feel of what Halloween felt like to be a teenage boy or even a pre-teenage boy. And that sense of mystery and that autumn coming and the fallen leaves and the prospect of going out for candy on a night that's kind of mysterious, like anything could happen. You know, you're walking around out there in the dark. At least we were in the 70s and 80s. So there was a lot of mystique that I held for the feeling of Halloween. And Ray Bradbury instilled that sense of Halloween and that sense of love for pretty literature, because his writing style is very, very pretty and very flowing and very, very articulate. So that might be the first book that did it. But there were movies that inspired me equally as much as the books I read. Night of the Living Dead impacted me in such a way. Like, that movie scared the bejesus out of me as a kid. I saw it much too young. The black and white, the lack of real hard gore, you know, it was more suspense.
Right.
That just scared the crap out of me, along with, you know, movies like Jaws and the first time I saw Halloween. Those were some of the movies that really, really did it. And then, of course, you know, episodes of The Twilight Zone need to be mentioned, too, because to capture that kind of a story in a half hour and then hit you with a surprise twist at the end that you don't see coming is truly a quality storytelling experience.
I actually just showed my 11-year-old. I was talking to her about The Twilight Zone, and I love The Twilight Zone. And I had actually showed her my favorite Twilight Zone episode, which is Time Enough at Last with Burgess Meredith. That's my favorite all-time episode. Oh my God. Just the ending is just so twisted, you know? And
heartbreak.
Yeah. Oh my and God. I didn't think she cared for it. And then, like, the next day, she goes, "Oh, Daddy, I watched the one you were talking about." I said, "Which one?" She goes, "To Serve Man." I said, "Oh, really? You watched that?" She goes, "Yeah." She goes, "That was weird." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Listen," I said, "they're all amazing. You know, they're so good, those shows, because they have everything encompassed into it. You know, like, you have time travel stuff, you have all sorts of horror stuff and aliens and ghosts. And I mean, it just, he was way ahead of his time, Rod Serling. I mean, he was incredible, that guy.
Yeah. And again, you know, to do it all in just a half an hour, have a full story, like, those are like movie length stories or they could be movies, you know, and then to hit the audience with that twist every time. It's brilliant, brilliant storytelling.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree. So what would you say is, like, your favorite subgenre of horror? Paranormal, you know, what's really, like, what's your go-to? Like, what's your favorite type?
I kind of really do like dystopian. I like these end of the world scenarios. I especially enjoyed it in Stephen King's The Stand, where the world is going to hell really fast due to a super flu epidemic, and the world is plunged into darkness. You know, the power goes out. The power is out completely. I love The Stand, Swan Song by Robert R. McCammon. There's a series called 1 Second After. That's, I forget the name, John, like, Forrester or something. A really great apocalyptic story. So I like the apocalyptic stories. I don't read zombie apocalypse that much, but I love realistic scenarios that set the world into darkness due to a man-made or natural catastrophe.
What's your writing process like? Like, how do you go about, like, I mean, that was always, I always have a million, I've been watching horror movies pretty much, you know, like all of us Generation X people, you know, I've been watching horror movies since I was 7 years old. When my parents would sit me in front of the TV and I'd be watching, you know, Friday the 13th Part 6, and they would have no idea what I'm watching, you know? You know, but what's really, like, what's your process? How do you go about thinking up these things? Or do they just come to you?
Ideas kind of germinate over time. I might get an initial idea for something, but usually the initial idea is never enough to go on. It has to kind of dwell. I get a lot of those split second great ideas in the final moments right before I fall asleep. And if it's a really good idea, it'll stay with me throughout the night into the morning and kind of grow. So I'll get an idea. I'll be thinking about it. Let it sit with me as the weeks or months pass. And eventually more ideas will grow from that initial idea into something where I'm like, okay, well, that's a story. The crazy thing is, though, the Ocean Ox, I just sat down at the computer and I said, you know what? Let me write a short story. And in the first book, there's one of the moms is telling the kids a ghost story at a Halloween party. And she starts telling the ghost story. And that was all, like, I was going to write. I just started writing it. And then I got into the second scene and killed somebody, I'm like, well, there's no end to this yet. I got to keep going. So I started writing, and all of a sudden I'm like, well, this is a bigger story. So I started, like, thinking about, well, what are the next scenes, you know? And before you knew it, like, the book was out of control. I had 100 characters. It was 500,000 page words long. So that book, like, I had no idea where it was going when I sat down to start writing it, which is very strange for any story to come out. But But now I usually sit down with a clear idea of what the story is going to be. And I'll set a goal of writing 2,000 words every time I sit down to write. And right now I'm in the process of writing a book, my next novel. And I feel, I've been sticking to every time I do sit down to write, I write 2,000 words, which is roughly 3 pages long. And, you know, if you figure if a novel is anywhere between, 70,000 to 100,000 words, I figure, if I stick to the writing process in 2 to 3 months, I should have a fairly decent first draft done.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, you recently published Try Not to Die in Arcanium in December 2024. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, so remember the old choose your own adventure stories. You get to a certain point in the book and you are faced with a path. So, you pick door A, pick door B. One of the doors that you pick or one of the paths, we offer you multiple paths throughout the book. One of them will lead to certain death. Possibly sometimes two of them will lead to certain death. One is the correct way to progress through the book. So Try Not to Die in Arcanium is essentially the prequel to the story Arcanium, which came out about a year or so ago. I co-wrote it with author Mark Towes. It's Arcanium is a virtual reality artificial intelligence program fused together that allows creatives such as horror authors to go inside and fuse with the program while one becomes the author creating their greatest, most terrifying story of their lives through the aid of virtual reality. The other players and participants become the characters in the story. And in Arcanium, the four horror authors take turns brutalizing the living hell out of each other inside the Arcanium virtual world. Try Not to Die in Arcanium follows a character named Ray, who's a down on his luck sort of guy who gets recruited by the Arcanium team to be one of the first test subjects for the prospect of earning $3,000 for a day's work. When he finds out that there's a lot more on the line than he thought, it gets quite terrifying, because if you get hurt or you die in Arcanium, you die in the real world. And Ray finds himself quickly in trouble along with the other 7 participants. And Try Not to Die in Arcanium is harkens back to the old choose your own destiny, choose your own path, sort of, I guess they were teen books of yesteryear. But this does it in a very adult way, giving the reader an interactive path to choose. Also, since Arcanium is an interactive game that involves the reader, it kind of perfectly fit with the Try Not to Die scenario.
So you said you wanted to do this off the cuff, right? So I actually have a question for you here.
Do it.
All right. If you could have authored any book, which one would that have been?
Oh, okay. Let's go with The Shining. So, The Shining by Stephen. It's going to be one of the early Stephen Kings. I was tempted to say The Stand, but geez, that's it's considered Stephen King's great. Can I narrow it down to 3? Because I would say The Stand, sure. It, or The Shining. Any of those. Like, if I could have written a horror classic in the 70s or early 80s that, because, what do you want to do as a writer? I want people to read my books. I want many people to read my books because I want to touch lives. I want to change the world one page at a time, if I can. And I want to affect the reader on an impactful level. Well, I can't think of many other books than The Shining that have really impacted that many on such a deep level. And the book, in my opinion, is better than the movie. I do love the movie. I know Stephen King was not a fan of the movie, but I do love the movie. I thought Jack Nicholson did a fantastic job, but the book truly shows a great character arc for Jack Torrance, the guy struggling with alcoholism, who is that becomes the doorway to let the evil inside. It's a great book. It's a must-read horror classic.
So let's get into this other thing now. So how did you get on Wheel of Fortune?
So it's 1999. I'm recently married, and I have my wife at the time. She's like much more outgoing than I am, and at the time, like, they would have things at the counter at the supermarket for to send in applications to, like, Family Feud or get on Wheel of Fortune. And I come home one day, she's like, "Hey, I got surprise." I'm like, "Okay, here we go." Because her surprises were definitely surprised. She goes, "I signed up to be a contestant on Wheel of Fortune." And I'm like, "Oh, great." She's like, "And I signed you up too." I'm like, "Oh, okay." But so there are applications, you know, and I'm like, "All right, we're never going to get called. I don't care if you signed us up." And we like get a call like a week later to come try out at a hotel. And now this is a little exciting. We get to the hotel and there's like 500 people all there to try out for Wheel of Fortune. Wow. There's a panel of five judges sitting at the front. Four women, one dude. And all they ask is, like, "We want you to stand up, introduce yourself, and tell us, you know, just a little bit like you would be introducing yourself on Wheel of Fortune." And I'm watching people do it, and I'm watching the reaction of the judges, and people are stumbling over their words. They're not talking like, you know, "Hey," you know, they don't really have that. And I see when a couple people do it that the judge's eyes kind of light up when somebody gets it right. So they get to me. I really don't know what I'm going to do. And I stand up and I say, "Hey, I'm Damon Manx. I'm a shipwrecked scuba diver. And when I met my wife, it was love at first sight." And the girls' judges, like four of them, their eyes beamed and these smiles broke out. I'm like, "I nailed it. I got it." And sure enough, I did get that. And I got called back to try out another time. My wife did as well. So we both go to the second tryout, which is to practice spinning the wheel. We're in New York City across from Madison Square Garden. So they just want you to spin the wheel and guess a letter. So I spin the wheel and I go X. And he's like, "Well, yeah, that's exactly how you do it." I goes, "X is never on Wheel of Fortune, but that's how you do it." Then my wife gets up and somebody stands in front of her. So she drops the ball. I knew she had lost it right there. About 2 weeks later, I get the call to come out to California to be on the show for Christmas week in 1999. Wow. And my wife, you know, she did not make it because she unfortunately dropped the ball at the last minute there. So I go out to California, Culver City. It's filming in November, going to air Christmas week, December of 1999. And I'm figuring, you know what? It's good chance it's going to be Christmas puzzles. So I start playing Hangman. I'm starting to play Wheel of Fortune on Nintendo. Every time I'm with somebody, I'm practicing Hangman. We go out and the stage is decked out like a Christmas tree. There's Christmas presents everywhere. There's trucks, there's cars. And the first puzzle goes and I don't even get to spin the wheel. Second, I'm standing in the middle. Second one, I get to spin the wheel and it's a huge puzzle. And I grab the wheel and I spin it and my mind goes blank. Like the world disappeared. Like it was just like I was lifted out of my body, and from another plane I'm watching and I'm listening, and this voice is calling S. And it's spinning the wheel, and it's landing on 1,000, and it's landing on 700. It's guessing R. It's buying vowels, and it's my voice. I'm doing it. I've got no control over anything. And I'm spinning the wheel, and I'm guessing these letters, and I'm buying these vowels. And Pat, at some point, goes, all right, would you like to spin or solve? And I look up, and out of this giant puzzle, there's like four letters missing. And I still can't, my mind can't register the puzzle. And I spin it one last time. It lands on an M, and there's M's. And it dawns on me. He's like, okay, spin or solve. Even he's like, you're pushing your luck. But I have no idea what it is. Finally, it dawns on me. And I say, I'd like to solve. The Grinch tried to steal Christmas from this town. That was the puzzle. He's like, yeah, you're right. And for an extra $3,000, could you tell us what town that was? Oh, of course I could. It's Whoville. Extra $3,000. I come out of this hypnotic state looking down at $16,000 that I had just won in one puzzle. Like, my heart is pounding, sweats on my forehead, on my palms. We go to commercial break. Girl next to me is just like, what the hell was that? I'm like, I have no idea. I go to the bonus round. I have enough money to make it to the bonus round. Phrase. It's a phrase, and like one letter comes up, the letter A, or and maybe in two spots. Wait, you get R-S-T-L-N-E. A couple letters show up. I guess my consonants and vowels, and barely anything pops. And it just snaps into my head, and I blurt out, I had a hunch. And he's like, yeah, that's it. There were like two letters on the board. It just came to me. I don't even know how it did. Divine intervention, whatever you want to call it. And he's like, all right, Charlie O'Donnell, let's show him what he won. He brings out this little package he brings out a stocking with these little packages in it. They're Christmas presents. He takes out the first one, and it shows a picture of snowboards. I'm like, oh, cool. I really don't like the snow. I'm going to be skiing, I guess. So it's the snowboards. And then he opens up the next package. And it's a rack system to put your snowboards on, which actually gets connected to the top of a truck. Then he opens up the next package, and it's a set of keys. And it's a keys to a 2000 Chevy Tahoe, fully loaded. Wow. Oh, my God. I jumped out. I hugged Pat so hard. My wife comes running on stage. She jumps on top of me. We're both hugging Pat. We're doing like this round, rosy, hugging each other. And it was, I think I used up all my luck in one single afternoon, a Wheel of Fortune that day. And awesome. Yeah.
That's a great story, still, man.
It's amazing. Like, it's insane. I've told this on TikTok. I've played the videos, and it's crazy. I still can't believe it happened to me. Like,
that's great.
Once in a lifetime thing, you know?
So let me ask you this about Wheel of Fortune. Is Vanna White as stunning in person as she is on TV?
No, actually.
Really?
So Vanna, even then in 1999, was very weathered. Her face was, you know, and when you get close, it was very... There's a large amount of lines, you know, going from her eyes down her cheeks. So she looks, you know, much older in person. She's very short, very small, very thin. And she was like, she held out her hand, but she was not really interested in shaking my hand. So I was a little turned off by Vanna White. Pat was very social, very, very cool. But Vanna, maybe it was me. I don't know. But Vanna was did not look as stunning in person and did not give me the warm and fuzzies either. Yeah, I'm sure she's a very lovely, lovely woman. Just didn't, you know, she's just not a Manx fan. What can I say?
Well, maybe now she is. Maybe now she is. Maybe she read some of your books and maybe now she is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully so.
So when did you start getting involved in the content creation?
So I, you know, when I, so oddly enough, you went remember MySpace? Remember a guy named Tom? So I was a musician back in the early 2000s and I had a couple CDs that I had come out with and I got on MySpace and I really like the marketing, self-marketing seemed to work really well for me. And I kind of blew up on MySpace and had a top downloaded song on the platform for quite a bit and did a little touring, playing my tunes. And, you know, then, well, MySpace went the way of the dinosaur and I went to prison. So when I got out, I'm like, well, you know, I want to be a horror author. I'm going to do everything I can. So I get on Facebook. I'm scared at first because, you know, I'm fresh out of prison. You know, I'm away for 8 years. So I'm not comfortable in settings of people yet. So hiding behind the keyboard and putting my persona out there was still a little intimidating. So I started on Facebook and everybody's like, hey, you go over to TikTok. And I started doing just talking about my story, talking about recovery, you know, since I have 12 years clean and sober. And I started talking about that. I started talking about my experience in prison and I was getting, you know, maybe 100 views, a couple hundred views at best. And what, well, I guess last year, somewhere right around February or March, one day I'm like, yeah, you know what? I started talking about the concert that was the best concert I ever went to. And I guess I put so much passion and emotion into my delivery. The video went viral and got like 800,000 views like overnight. Wow. And it seemed to, it just grew from there. Like from there, like, you know, I started talking more about music, started asking musical questions and the platform has identified me as a musical content creator and people have, I guess, enjoy what I'm putting out because it's continued to grow since. And I've had multiple videos that have gone in crazy viral on the platform. Yeah. Wow. So I became a content creator on TikTok, which has become my main day job, which allows me to write all day.
Wow.
And I also do the TikTok shop, which companies pay me to promote their guitars and their products, their headphones and whatnot, and send me free products and offer me commission on sales too. So TikTok has been very good to me, and I sure hope they don't ban the platform.
Yeah. Yep.
Because I don't want to go back to delivering Grubhub.
Listen, I just hit, like yesterday, I hit 1,000 followers. And I'm like, of course, I hit 1,000 followers and it's going to get banned in 3 days, you know? Well, why not? Right? That's just my luck. You know, last year I bought a snowblower. It hasn't snowed since. You know, it's just what happens, you know?
That's how it happens, man. You know, but any luck, maybe we'll be able to continue to grow a little while.
I like we were talking about before, I think somebody's going to save it at the 0 hour. Somebody's going to save it. I can't see it going dark. The other thing I'm kind of upset about that I didn't realize today, my 11-year-old told me, was that CapCut might be also banned as well because that's part of the same company. I'm like, oh no, that's what I do all my videos with, CapCut. I like CapCut, you know?
Yeah, CapCut. I think WhatsApp is connected to them as well.
No. Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's going to be a big hit. That's why I really doubt that it's going to go away. Hopefully not for all of our sakes, because I enjoy
I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all are. So what do you have coming up in the near future?
So I'm doing about a show a month, taking the books on the road and doing some book signings, books, horror conventions. I'm working on the next book as we speak, writing that. I'm going to be releasing the omnibus version of the Oceanox, which is a giant hardcover, which contains all four books of the series all in one. It's an 1,100 page hardcover, black bound book with illustrations inside. That's coming out this year. I have another story, actually a book that's two stories combined. That's a one story very much in the vein of a Dark Half kind of story, where the author actually plays a part in the story himself. And there's a second story in that book, which is a prequel to one of the characters from the Oceanox, a very dark and dangerous character.
Awesome. Awesome. That's great, man. So how can someone check out your content and your books and everything? How could they find you?
Yeah. So I'm at every social media platform except for X. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok. And it's really all you need to know is the name Damon Manx, which is spelled DaeMonManx. But I have two websites, my own, which is www.DaemonManx.com, spelled again the same way. And at Last Waltz Publishing, Last Waltz, as in the dance publishing, that's where you can get my books directly. I sell signed copies of all my books through the Last Waltz Publishing website. If you were to go on to the DaemonManx.com, you could get linked right to the Last Waltz site very easily as well. So there are multiple ways to get them. I'm also at Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and Walmart.com.
Awesome. Awesome. So, and actually also for everybody listening, I'm also going to have all of the links in the show notes as well. So anybody could just click on the links and find all that stuff as well. So I'll put that all together when I tell you when the show is coming out and stuff. And, listen, man, thank you so much for being here, and I appreciate you coming on. We finally got to do this. That's awesome. And it was good talking to you.
It was great talking to you, my friend. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening, everyone, and thank you to Mr. Damon Manx for joining me tonight. You can find all of his links for his socials and to purchase his books in the show notes, and that's going to do it for us, guys. Have a great night. And I'll talk to you next week. Later.
Thank you for listening to the Warp Reality Podcast. And thank you to all my guests and contributors that helped make this show possible. For more episodes, guest info, social media links, merch, and more, please check out warprealitypodcast.com. If you have a paranormal experience you would like to share, questions, comments, or you'd like to be a guest in the show, please leave me a voicemail at 845-600-0744, or you can email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You can do so anonymously if you'd like. Also, I'd greatly appreciate it if you could leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or WarpRealityPodcast.com. Have a great night, everyone, and don't forget to change your shorts.